This is Press Watch. Good morning. It's 9 o'clock Pacific time. And this is the news you're not supposed to know. Well, here we are at the end of the decade. And I for one, would be glad to say goodbye to it, particularly to 2019. First, as we bid goodbye to the 20-teens, I want to point out that the U.S. economy is built on hype, that it represents an enormous bubble, and that the bubble is going to pop. Central banks' balance sheets are obviously stretched. I want to explain what I mean by that. The Baltic Dry Index, the meter of actual commodities changing hands in the world's shipping lanes, decreased 192 points, or almost 15%, from its high of 2,500 at the beginning of this year, 2019. Historically, the Baltic Exchange Dry Index reached an all-time high of 11,793 in May of 2008. You know what happened that year. So everything we're looking at since then is chump change by comparison. We're, at the most, at the beginning of the year, we were only up to less than a quarter of that. And since then, we have lived in a finance bubble economy. And you've probably heard that before, and you're wondering, what's that mean? Well, what it means is going to become much more apparent. On-paper lending assets of the major central banks, the U.S. Federal Reserve, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan are at $14.5 trillion in November 2019. And that's down only slightly from a peak of around $15 trillion early 2018, and more than 3.5 times the pre-2007 level of $4 trillion. So those are just numbers, but those are assets in the sense that they are loans that the banks hope will pay out completely. Whenever there is a crisis in the markets, a percentage of those loans do not pay out, and the value of the collateral always turns out to be a fraction of what the loans represented. This was the case in 2008, as you may recall, with Bear Stearns, etc. Not just because they were inflated to begin with, but because in a crisis market, the buyers are uninterested, and the price of whatever, stocks, oil, loans, what have you, goes down. It's a matter of supply and demand. Compare the size of these loans with their national economies, and you get an interesting warning. Japan bank assets, for example, are at 102% of Japan's nominal gross domestic product. Europe is at 39%, and the U.S. is at 17%. But of course, the U.S. depends on European and Japanese stability. And that's something, again, we saw in 2008. Uber, the company that made its name using investor cash to wipe out taxi services across the world, is a cash burner still. And I say that because people say, oh, well, look how well we're doing with this, the success of Uber across the world. It's not a real success. It's taking $8 billion from its investors this year with no payout in sight. They don't actually produce things. They're just trying to create a monopoly so that their investors will be able to eventually jack up taxi prices out of sight, and everyone will be forced to pay because there won't be any real alternative. Tesla, which everyone seems to think is the coming thing, is still burning up billions from investors, even though there's been a very convenient coup sourcing lithium from Bolivia. Even Netflix is consuming cash by the billions. Not all of these businesses and national economies are going to pan out. And when they fail, billions of dollars in value are going to vanish. Again, this is partly because that value isn't really there. It's just speculation. Speaking of speculation, subprime auto loans are a substantial minority portion of the auto loan market. And their 90-day and 60-day defaults number in the millions in the U.S. These are early defaults from people who are granted new or new-ish cars without a professionally vetted process. In other words, they never had the ability to pay for the cars, which are now being repossessed to be refurbished and resold at a fraction of their initial sales value, thereby stiffing the gambling investors who paid out for the ridiculously high interest loans that will never be paid back. And about 1 in 20 of these subprime loans are already collapsing. You know, when you're 2 months and 3 months behind on paying for your car, you ain't gonna pay for the car. More than that, the millions of people who are depending on those cars to get to work and even to live in are now without the power those cars gave them, so they will lose jobs and lose credit and spend that much less into the economy. The sad thing is that these people, maybe you're one of them, were hoping that the new car would help get that third job to pay for it, but it turns out that you weren't superhuman. Right now, the finance-fueled economy is still running at freeway speed, but it's about to slam to a halt with its central processing unit bricked by GPS. And that metaphor comes from a real thing, as you may know. That's how repossession sometimes works. In 2007, I was screaming on these airwaves to get the hell out of Washington Mutual because loan valuation had so grossly exceeded actual assets, and I don't think many people were listening. Maybe you remember. And I can't say when this Jenga tower is going to topple exactly, but I can say that it's going to hit the table and the floor at some point. We don't need another infusion of free cash for billionaires, which is the way the Obama administration and the Trump administration deals with it. We don't need to keep this fraud economy going. What we need is a Green New Deal that will employ us at decent wages while building a new durable and non-climate-killing infrastructure. I'd be interested to know what you think about that. So you can call in. This is live radio here in Portland, Oregon. The number to call is 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Related comments on economics coming up in a few minutes by way of Rashida Tlaib and Bernie Sanders. But right now, some of the news you're not supposed to know. The crisis in Chile continues. The repression of ongoing protests in Chile has resulted in the most serious human rights violations in 30 years since the country was ruled by the military dictatorship. That's according to Radio Havana, Cuba, quoting the country's National Institute of Human Rights. According to the director of Chile's official human rights body, his name is Sergio Mico, the state's response to the mass protests produced as a whole, this is a quote, the most serious of multiple violations of human rights committed since 1989, end quote. In his annual report, focusing on the crisis that began in mid-October, Mico details that the indiscriminate use of force, torture, and sexual violence have been repeated in time and space during the current crisis. He's quoted saying, This happened in democracy, in our democracy. How was it possible? That is what this report is about, which we never thought we would have to write, end quote. Massive demonstrations against the Chilean government began in Santiago on October 14th due to a 30-cent increase on the subway fare. While that measure was revoked by the Chilean president, social unrest increased in magnitude as the Chileans began to question 30 years of neoliberal policies, which have implied a systematic withdrawal of economic and social rights for millions of people. And Radio Havana writes, since the start, the response of the security forces have been internationally condemned for their blatant disregard of human rights. Currently, prosecutors are investigating at least 26 deaths in the context of the crisis, including killings by military and police forces. Now, I want to depart from that script here and say that these are not mistakes. These 26 killings are intentional because they are intended to intimidate the population, and it's effective to do so. It's not as effective as they would like because Chileans are continuing to protest. And again, those 26 deaths are, of course, intended to remind everyone of the thousands of deaths during the Henry Kissinger-approved repression in the 1970s and 80s. Returning to Radio Havana's script, NHRI describes human rights violations as serious and multiple and criticizes excessive delay by the Carabineros in taking measures to prevent further violations. The Institute has initiated hundreds of legal actions against the authorities for murder, torture, sexual violence, and other abuses. Shortly after the NHRI submitted its report, Chilean President Sebastián Piñera gave a 29-minute speech at the presidential palace. He did not refer to the report, but instead mentioned in general terms the importance of total, absolute, and unrespected respect for the human rights of all persons at all times, in all places, and under all circumstances, end quote. However, the government and security forces have framed these violations as isolated incidents of excess, vehemently rejecting international reports that claim otherwise, despite condemnations by the UN and other international bodies and the government's promises to respect human rights. Police repression has been systematically violent, abusive, and indiscriminate. According to Francisco Sepulveda, one of the doctors who voluntarily treat wounded protesters, it is repression at all costs, he said to Al Jazeera, and he added that repression measures in the slums have been particularly violent. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland at 11 o'clock. Well, at 10 o'clock, we're going to have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, so I know that you will want to stay tuned for that. At 11, it's going to be Book Wave, where National Book Award-winning novelist Ha Jin discusses his latest book, The Banished Immortal. At 11:30, we'll have Words and Pictures, where host S.W. Konser will speak to Raina Telgemeier, author and illustrator who has inspired many young readers with her graphic memoirs, Smile and Guts. KBOO is an independent, non-commercial community radio station powered by volunteers and members. Please take a moment to pull up kboo.fm and click on our give guide. kboo.fm/give, but you don't have to bother with a slash since the button's right there. Just press that, won't you, and have a look. You're eligible for more than $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. And don't forget, it's the end of the year, so you can get that money back, toot sweet, by donating now and putting it on your tax return. We are a 501c3 educational nonprofit foundation. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on donate. I also want to say that I'm going to podcast now, and kboo.fm is, of course, becoming a media hub rather than just a terrestrial radio station. This is increasingly important. You can help. You can help people find this radio program and other radio programs and find KBOO generally. You can help people in Japan and Europe find KBOO by going to a podcast hub. Go to your favorite one, Switcher, whatever you like, Apple Podcasts, and find your favorite program. Find Press Watch if you like. And don't forget to rate and review. And when you do that, of course, it goes up in the rankings and other people can see it. Until that happens, it remains invisible. So we are at a point in which this is interesting, because your participation as a member of KBOO and as a KBOO listener is super important as to whether we survive the upcoming decade. Will there be a KBOO media hub in the 2020s? It's down to you, really. And I suggest that if you believe in community radio, if you believe in getting the truth out, especially as we fight to save the planet, as we fight against fascism, as we move forward through impeachments, maybe you want to just take a second. Pull up kboo.fm, pull up the podcasts on Apple or on Switcher, whichever ones you prefer. iTunes. Returning to KBOO Press Watch News Briefs, Greenpeace Japan, an international environmental NGO, announced on October 4th that a radiation survey conducted around Jay Village in October 2019, that's the 2020 Tokyo Olympic Village, revealed several hot spots. The spot was confirmed, and a radiation dose of up to 71 microsieverts per hour at ground contact and 1.7 microsieverts at 1 meter height was announced. Greenpeace has already notified the environmental minister of the findings of the survey and has recommended that periodic radiation monitoring and decontamination be carried out. Why is this important to you? If you go to the Tokyo Olympics, then you need to be concerned with this contamination. It's not those, 71 microsieverts per hour is not going to hurt you in and of itself. And you're just not going to stick around long enough for that to really bother you. The problem is that it is caused by the dust, the Fukushima dust that was blasted into the atmosphere, and some of which blew into Tokyo and remains. Tokyo is contaminated by Fukushima. Don't forget that, because this stuff becomes dangerous when you breathe it in. Particularly the alpha emitters are dangerous, and when you ingest it in other ways, through your mouth, through your eyes and skin. You need to stay clean if you're going to the Olympics, and you may want to take decontamination measures after you leave. Returning to the information from Greenpeace Japan, some of the hotspots identified here were among the hotspots found in Greenpeace radiological surveys since 2011. These hotspots have already been decontaminated officially. It is located in a damaged area and is now a place, pardon me, this is a translation which is a little clumsy, and is now a place where ordinary people come and go, so there are concerns about its impact on health. And this area is also the starting point for the torch relay of the Tokyo Olympics this year. They go on that they demand that the government conduct immediate and extensive radiological and hotspot surveys of public areas around Jay Village and surrounding Olympic and Paralympic venues. By the way, if you talk about this sort of thing in the press in Japan, you can go to jail. And I would guess if the word gets through that I've talked about this on KBOO, the Japanese government isn't going to be happy about it. But fortunately, at this point, there's not a damn thing they can do about it, because we don't answer to the corporations here. This is your radio station, KBOO. Remember what I was saying about contributing? It's down to you. Now, returning to Radio Havana Cuba's news items, Dateline Damascus, the United States is building a large military base within the Alamar oil field in the province of Deir Ezzor in Syria. The U.S. is equipping the base to serve as the command headquarters for the International Coalition's operations. That's according to the Syria Now portal. They said, besides fortifying the field with logistic and military reinforcements, the U.S. Army is building airstrips for its helicopters, which will be used to monitor oil wells from the air. According to Syrian analysts, Washington is working to find a mechanism that makes it easier to extract as much Syrian oil as quickly as possible. To do so, the U.S. is moving electrical equipment to put the electricity network into operation at the oil fields, which would allow it to begin to exploit them. The information is that the U.S. and its allies continue to misinform the international community about the situation in Syria. Radio Havana Cuba reports this hinders the process of returning Syrian citizens to their homeland. Previously, the U.S. government withdrew its soldiers from 11 military bases in Syria and concentrated them in the oil fields located in Rimilan. The Alamar base will replace the base that existed at the Lafarge cement factory in Syria, from which U.S. troops withdrew in November. On December 20th, the acting charge of affairs of Syria's permanent mission to the UN, Luai Falu, asked Washington to end the theft of oil and gas resources belonging to the Syrian state and to withdraw its forces from the Arab country. The Syrian ambassador also rejected the draft resolution for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs on his country's current situation, as it does not address the humanitarian objectives mentioned in its content. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:16. We have the hour today. And so I would be happy to take your calls at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. I started off talking about the tottering international finance economy. And I would be interested to know what you think about that. A lot of you are just scraping by. I know statistically, a whole lot of you, and when to hear this sort of news can't be pleasing, but you need to know in advance what's coming up. Allows you to plan, allows you to get some idea of what's coming down the pike. Now, speaking of the economy, I want to pass on words of Bernie Sanders and Rashida Tlaib, who wrote an article in The Guardian jointly. And they write, when it comes to billionaires benefiting from the generosity of the American taxpayer, the holiday spirit is alive year-round. Taxpayers paid out $115 million to Donald Trump so he could play golf at his own resorts. And Amazon didn't just pay zero in federal taxes on $11 billion in profits. Taxpayers gifted the corporation $129 million in rebates. And that's enough to pay for CEO Jeff Bezos' 3 apartments in Manhattan, including a penthouse that cost him $80 million. And what about government generosity for those who actually need help? Tax dollars are somehow much harder to come by when they're not going to handouts for the rich. The average person in poverty, struggling to put food on the table, gets about $134 a month in nutrition assistance. Now, leaving that script and speaking for myself, this is particularly on the government, because the government has provided billions, trillions of dollars, actually, in bailout to the very rich since the 2007-2008 crisis. It's been free money for them, and they've been doing so well that they've changed, for example, the cityscape of New York, which is now spiked with needles, which are grand and glorious houses, actually, that are simply for the residences of the super rich. They're not public buildings in any useful sense. They're simply real estate stacking super high. It's the house in the sky economy, and this is for people who have accumulated, I won't say earned, people who have arrogated billions of dollars from the labor of thousands and millions of people. Uber executives, for example. So returning to Rashida Tlaib and Bernie Sanders' text, now just in time for the holidays, Trump has finalized the first of 3 policies that will make this disparity even more obscene. 2 years after passing a $1.5 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest Americans and large corporations, the Trump administration plans to strip 3.7 million people of their nutrition benefits. The administration's first step is to kick 700,000 adults off of nutrition assistance as they struggle to find work. The second step, trying to punish families who have high child care and housing costs. And third, they want to hurt families who already are making difficult choices between food or heat. Together, the three proposals will cut billions of dollars from one of our nation's leading anti-poverty programs. Meanwhile, the Republican tax scam is working exactly as planned. Today, the richest 400 billionaires pay lower taxes than any group in America, including the poor. Nearly 100 of the top Fortune 500 companies pay nothing in taxes. This is what oligarchy looks like. Trump's appetite to shower the ultra-wealthy with corporate welfare is endless, and so is his administration's willingness to assault our nation's most vulnerable and hungriest families. Republicans defend this by saying that keeping people hungry will make them work harder, but we know this is just about cruelty. We know that withholding food from needy people who are underemployed only deepens the crisis of poverty in America. And again, I want to depart from the script and say this is a Democratic Party script. Sanders is, of course, running for president, and Tlaib is a member of the Democratic Party, and the implication here is that the Democrats will make things better, but I hope that you remember that they are pretty happy with corporate rule themselves. Nevertheless, I would like to persist reading this. Some states will be hit harder than others. Vermont could see a 30% cut to benefits, and one in five low-income people who rely on nutrition assistance could no longer be eligible to participate. In Michigan, about 1 in 7 would be kicked off food aid with an estimated 15% cut in benefits. This is absolutely devastating. It goes without saying, they write, that we must fight as hard as we can against the Trump administration's savage attack on nutrition assistance, but we need to go beyond that. We must demand that the ultra-wealthy finally start paying their fair share so that we can dramatically expand nutrition support. In the richest country in the history of the world, we have a moral obligation to eradicate the hunger that more than 37 million of our fellow Americans suffer every day. We can start by increasing nutrition assistance by $47 per person per month. That is the shortfall between what low-income people need to prepare adequate meals and what they get in benefits. We should also significantly increase the income threshold for this program so everyone who needs help gets it. We must also guarantee that all school children get free breakfast and lunch at every public school in America, and we should also lift the onerous conditions on what people can buy with nutrition assistance. Again, this is from Sanders and Rashida Tlaib. One Vermonter shared how in the cold winter months she wished she could buy her children a hot roasted chicken from the store because she had no access to an oven. Under the current program, she can only buy the day-old cold roasted chicken. Multiple Michigan families have similar stories to share. These are the kinds of requirements that force poor people to jump through humiliating hoops, but they accomplish nothing in the fight to end hunger. Ultimately, we must make a choice as a society. Will we tolerate the insatiable greed and cruelty of the billionaire class? Interested to know your answer to that question. 503-231-8187. And I said last week, and I want to repeat, that the crisis in Chile is referred to blandly when it's referred to at all here in the U.S. as something that happened because of an increase in subway fares. That's not really the case. And when you hear that Chileans live on a few hundred per month, you think, oh, that's too bad for those Chileans. It's too bad their economy is not so great. But, well, the fact is, currency is just different in Chile. And you can get by on close to $1,000 a month in Chile. They're getting substantially less than that. And not only that, just like here, they are subjected to a system that has crushed people no matter how well they educate themselves, no matter how long and how hard they work. They cannot hope to achieve the point in which they can offer stability to their children and grandchildren. That American dream that we go on about, and which is a fantasy now, that social mobility, which also doesn't exist here, has reached the breaking point in Chile, and they have had the sense to rise up and say, we have a right to participate in the society, and that means access to adequate economic distribution. Maldistribution of wealth is the problem that we have in the United States, and is the problem with the Chileans. And the Chileans have finally said, no more of this. The wealth that the workers generate must be distributed in a rational way. But we won't go there in the United States. We suffer from this severe delusion that we're going to become billionaires. I assure you, that is not going to happen. I don't care how virtuous you are. And real virtue would mean standing with your fellow citizens against the corporate oligarchy and their two political parties and demanding that you get enough to live on. Enough to live on, enough to have a stable, and well, enough to have a house, enough to have your own housing, and enough to get ahead, literally, to accumulate wealth in this severely overfunded society. The fact is, there's so much money in the society, and it is so poorly distributed. Two evils, which allow imperialism to go on. Well, anyway, returning to Sanders and Rashida Tlaib, defending already inadequate benefits is not enough. Ultimately, we must make a choice as a society. Will we tolerate the insatiable greed and cruelty of the billionaire class, whose control over our political system lets them take food out of the mouth of hungry school kids? Or do we build a humane, equitable society that ends poverty, hunger, and homelessness and allows everyone to live with dignity? As the new year approaches, let us commit to fighting for a government and an economy that works for the overwhelming majority of the people. That is how we will make food security a human right in America. And again, that is the end of the message from Bernie Sanders and Rashida Tlaib. What are your comments and questions? 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Bernie Sanders is tweeting, "Here's a prediction. We are going to win, pass a Green New Deal, and criminally prosecute the fossil fuel executives who destroyed the planet." What do you think? You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. News you're not supposed to know. And so now I'd like to turn to climate change. Loss of oxygen from the world's oceans, driven by climate change, is increasingly threatening the ability of the oceans to support life. That's in an article by Anders Lorentzen on A Greener Life, A Greener World.net. And he is quoting the conservation group, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, in a report released earlier this month at the COP25 summit in Madrid. They found that the loss of oxygen is threatening fish species and disrupting ecosystems. It's driven by climate change and nutrient pollution, and it is especially threatening species such as tuna, marlin, and sharks. Many tuna species are already threatened by overfishing and fishing methods. Speaking for myself, this, of course, is going to affect the price of food, the loss of the ability to gather fish from the oceans is going to increase the food price across the globe. And of course, and it's more of a loss than that, of course, more than just a matter of price. The report, Ocean Deoxygenation, Everyone's Problem, is the largest peer-reviewed study so far looking at the causes, impacts, and possible solutions to ocean deoxygenation. It finds that ocean regions with low oxygen concentrations are expanding and that around 700 sites worldwide are now affected by low oxygen conditions. This is a rise from about 45 in the 60s. Additionally, during the same period, the volume of anoxic waters, which are areas completely depleted of oxygen, has quadrupled. As the ocean warms, its waters hold less oxygen and become more buoyant. This leads to a reduced mixing of the oxygen-rich water near the surface with ocean depths, which naturally contain less oxygen. Nutrient pollution causes oxygen loss in coastal waters such as fertilizer, sewage, animal, and aquaculture waste, causing excessive growth of algae, which in turn deplete oxygen as they decompose. Speaking for myself, this is particularly evident near the mouth of the Mississippi, where agricultural runoff and sewer runoff from the United States spews into the Gulf of Mexico and creates a vast anoxic zone, a dead zone. There's also a dead zone off the coast of Oregon, and if I remember correctly, it is caused in large part by the dairy effluent flowing into the area. Dr. Grethel Aguilar explained that with this report, it is now clear for everyone to see what the scale of damage, what the scale is of damage that climate change is inflicting on the ocean. She stated, quote, "As the warming ocean loses oxygen, the delicate balance of marine life is thrown into disarray. The potentially dire effects on fisheries and vulnerable coastal communities mean that the decisions made at the ongoing UN Climate Change Conference are even more crucial. To curb ocean oxygen loss, Alongside the other disastrous aspects of climate change, world leaders must commit to immediate and substantial emission cuts, end quote. What do you think? Do you think world leaders are ready to commit to immediate and substantial emission cuts? I'll wait for you to stop laughing bitterly. What do you think needs to be done to make that happen? I've been talking about general strike. It's a concept. As a polemicist, as a propagandist, this is something that I've brought up for many, many years, the idea of a general strike, and I'm pleased to see that I now hear echoes that other people are calling for a general strike. One traditional day for general strike is May 1st. May 1st, 2020, I wonder what will happen, but I'll go to the first caller, 503-231-8187, and Dennis is on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say, maybe people generally know about this. There was an article in the New York Times Sunday magazine a little over 2 years ago, in the summer of 2017, devoted entirely to an article entitled 30 years ago, we could have saved the planet. That was the title of the article. And I think I've been told that by friends that it's been updated since then. It's going to be sooner. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in. It's just,
well, I think it's interesting that you bring that up. I have been, you know, following climate change for decades now, and one suspicion that has been growing in my mind is that the big corporations, the big oil corporations like Exxon, have not only known about global warming, but have probably planned to profit from last-minute geoengineering schemes.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Oh, I didn't know that. All right, well, thank you.
Well, I don't know that for a fact. I just think that I'm just predicting that from the way that they generally act. They kept it secret that they knew about climate change, and they are all about profit and planning in advance for profit. So I'd be surprised if they have not invested in geoengineering schemes of an intrusive character. But thanks
okay,
for your...
I just wanted to say, in that article, it's very interesting. I know that it's been updated. My sister told me it was updated. But the interesting thing about that article is the fantastic photography. I don't know if you've ever seen it. The photography of the places around the world where things are melting. I mean, it's just, I don't know if you, I'm sure you can still get it. All right, that's all I wanted to say. Anyway, I hope that it might help people. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Yes, as I've been commenting on the last few weeks, the Siberian permafrost is, and the Alaskan and Canadian permafrost are melting to the point that whole areas, vast tracts of land have lost their character and have become swampy hummocks. Dotted with ponds, almost impossible to cross without specialized equipment. And that means that the ecosystems that they represent are changing as they become, just different areas, different places, different ecosystems. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And I'm going to bring up Facebook so that you can comment on the on their messaging system. Let's see. It's called, what is it called? There's a name for it and I can't remember right now. Anyway, if you are already on my feed on Teresa Mitchell on Facebook, then you can bring up a message and comment or give a question in that manner. But returning to the article from A Greener Life, agreenerworld.net, tuna, marlin, and sharks are particularly sensitive to low oxygen because of their large size and energy demands. These species are being driven into increasingly shallow surface layers of oxygen-rich water, making them more vulnerable to overfishing. And speaking for myself, there's only so much money available for this kind of research. And so when they say that tuna, marlin, and sharks are particularly sensitive. Also, that is the thing that would be noticed first, because that is what the fishing industry is interested in. And when fish stocks that these fish depend on, when plankton stocks collapse, we're going to see an effect on the predators, on the apex predators. Returning to the article, the report outlines just how devastating these changes can be for hundreds of millions of people depending on the oceans for their livelihood. It explains some of the ocean's most productive biomes, which support one-fifth of the world's wild marine fish harvest, which are formed by ocean currents carrying nutrient-rich but oxygen-poor water to coasts that line the eastern edges of the world's ocean basins. As naturally oxygen-poor systems, these areas are particularly vulnerable to even small changes in ocean oxygen. And they write, crucially, low oxygen in the ocean can impact more than the ocean species. It also affects the basic processing of nitrogen and phosphorus, crucial to sustaining life on Earth. By 2100, they say, the ocean is expected to lose 3 to 4% of its oxygen inventory if we carry on with business as usual. Here again, I want to speak for myself. See the sort of prediction, and generally, I don't know specifically in this case, but generally, it's a straight line prediction rather than looking at the acceleration in the phenomenon, which, and sometimes the data is simply unavailable to make that sort of projection. It's a straight line prediction of a phenomenon which will occur if observed conditions continue with that small data set. In other words, this is likely to be very optimistic. And I say that because I've been reporting on this sort of thing since the mid-90s, and I've seen continually the reporting becoming, the reported facts becoming more and more alarming, and the whole process is moving much faster than anyone predicted a couple of decades ago. And it's your world. And as Naomi Klein has pointed out, the capitalist system really doesn't care that this is happening. The people who drive the policy that business shall continue and even accelerate as usual for the petroleum economy, they're going to be doing just fine, while the rest of us suffer from increased asthma, from the increased pollen, which is just that's just baked in right now. Every year the pollen's going to get worse and your asthma is going to get worse. They're not going to have to worry about that because they're going to have fine, isolated houses with expensive filtration systems that they can afford to buy new filters for, and they won't be breathing that pollen all of the time. You will. You don't have money for that. You don't have money for a bunker when the storms become severe. You have to take what housing you can get and barely hang on, and that brings me back to what I was talking about earlier this morning. What are you willing to tolerate? And are you willing to rise up as the Chileans have? Because that's what it's going to take. Incremental reform is scarcely possible under this corporate-owned system, corporate-owned election system, and incremental process in any event isn't going to save you and your kids from climate change. Is going to get worse every single year. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. What would it take for you to decide that you want a better world and are willing to go to the streets to get it? General strike or not? This year's extreme weather broke more than 120,000 daily records across the U.S., from temperatures to precipitation and snowfall records. That's according to the National Climatic Data Center, reported on WMUR.com. They write, while the total number of daily records aren't that unusual compared to previous years, meteorologist Guy Walton told CNN the bigger picture is unusual. And he's quoted saying, we should see the wettest year in recorded history, at least since records have been kept in 1895, end quote. This meteorologist, Guy Walton, has 30 years' experience. The Midwest was particularly hit hard earlier this year with large areas underwater. The flooding devastated farms in parts of Nebraska and Iowa, killing livestock and ruining harvests. And climate experts suggest that the extreme nature of this year's weather, from record flooding to record highs, is a red flag. It was 70 degrees in Alaska in March. There were a lot of first-time evers for communities across the U.S. The first time... I'll let you read the rest of that article, which gets into specifics. The 4th of July, Anchorage was hotter than Key West at 90 degrees. This sort of thing changes ecosystems. As I was saying, this increases pollen in the air. It also increases mold in the air, increases asthma. This is just the edge of the effects. And, of course, the heat waves for the Northern Hemisphere will be coming this summer, when we will suffer, as Australia is now suffering. Just a week ago, 117 degrees recorded in Australia as the outback burned, and as Sydney was wreathed in smoke to the degree that was scarcely visible. Time is 9:40 Pacific time. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. The number to call is 503-231-8187, and Rena is on the air.
Hi, I'm here visiting Portland, but I'm from Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
I turned on the radio and I heard you say general strike, and I just wanted to call to resonate that, because I am totally convinced that until we become militant, whatever word we want to use, and strike would be one example, we are not going to get anywhere. I'm totally convinced of that. And as I observe people who are working in climate change, I live in Massachusetts, what I see is people engaged in largely symbolic acts, and really not getting the bigger picture. I'm very despairing, I have to tell you, about what's happening, because I don't see us rising to the urgency of what's happening. And I'll stop one, but I want to make one other point.
Uh-huh.
Less in the vein of urgency, but I think equally important, I don't get why climate action people are not seriously behind Bernie Sanders. He's not perfect, but he's certainly the best that we have, and I really do believe that he will fight corporate power, which is exactly what we need to have happen. So neither on the more electoral part of things, or in terms of the more militant activities, do I unfortunately really see the kind of critical mass of people rising to the occasion. And but part of me, I mean, I feel like I am constantly riding the thin line between utter despair and keeping on fighting.
Well, I want to say this about militancy. It's really about compassion. It's really about a breakout of people looking at each other, looking in each other's eyes and saying, I got your back, let's go out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, some people kind of shy away from the word militancy. All I mean is, I don't mean violence. I mean, we have got to seriously confront the powers. I mean, you use the examples of Chile or Iraq or whatever. That kind of rising up and saying, this has got to change, you know. And until that happens, I really don't think anything substantial is going to happen. I mean, if you look at the plans for development, you know, the details evade me, but the people that are studying the plans of advanced countries, they are planning to increase the use of carbon CO2 producing elements by 150%. In the works are already plans to worsen, much less to mitigate. So,
and that's the nature of corporations. They're set up for that that next quarterly report. And so ideas of participating in healing the world are just something that goes to the PR department, and what they're actually going to do is what's going to bring them money.
Yes, but on the other side, the other part of it is, what do we do to awaken people? And there we confront the stranglehold of the mass media, which is appearing to me, the more I live, the mass media is perhaps the single most critical thing that we have to change.
Well, that brings me back to community radio. I hope that you will look up this as a podcast. It'll be available on KBOO.FM, also on Switcher, on App Podcasts, and you'll be able to hear the entirety of the program that way. Just about half an hour after the program's over, it goes automatically into the podcast.
Sure. Well, listen, I love KBOO. I think you're the best thing out there. I don't know any other station that is as informative as KBOO is. I really appreciate it. Anyway, I do wish we would speak to the Bernie thing, because I don't get it. I don't get why 350.org and all the environmental groups aren't pushing this.
Well,
let's
admit that Sanders' campaign has been actively suppressed. It was actively suppressed in 2016 to the point of rigging the Democratic primary so that if you thought you were voting for Sanders, your ballot would be thrown away. And it's actively suppressed in the press. This is very clear from the statistics that have been kept since that 2016 run. The press would rather talk about anything than a socialist running for president.
Yep. And he gets climate change. You know, he was one of the first people to really articulate it, at least on that in the public platform, people. And way back to 2007, he introduced and got passed one of the first and largest energy conservation bills. So, I mean, again, to me, it's like I see all these organizations, and we've only got a short time before this election, and why there is not concentrated work around Bernie Sanders and raising awareness of climate change as we do that. I mean, that's what I do. I'm just bewildered by the kind of fragmented, almost apathetic way of looking what's coming up in this election, because if Donald Trump gets reelected, I'm talking just about climate change, it's very hard for me to feel any hope.
Well, thank you very much for your comments.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll go to Camilo next. The number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Hello, Camilo. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to speak very narrowly to the question that the person speaking before me brought up, to the fact that she's kind of on this knife edge between hope and despair and feeling positive about things that can be done and that are being done by various people who are working on them. We live with this notion of hope, and it seems like we believe in a concept that hope is a very real thing that keeps us going, that motivates us, that gives us a vision of something that's going to happen in the future, or of something that is going to come from outside to make a difference. But that really is a construct that we've created that we can realize is not real. It's a delusion. Unless you characterize hope as something that gives you a personal motivation to do something, hope is only really a real experience when you're active in working on something. And it's that work, that action, that creates the hope. However, the hope that is created out of action cannot rely on knowing what the outcome of your action can do. You do the action because it's the right thing to do. And we've all been talking about what we need to do and what are the right actions. And you don't have to rely on some expectation that they're going to be fulfilled.
I have to agree. I mean, when I go out, for example, When I go out, for example, to record a protest, for example, when I went out to the ICE occupation, it was satisfying to get out there and do something. I mean, here we are at the end of 2019, and we still have this monstrous situation of caged and separated children bawling from the absence of their parents. But going out and actually doing something, filing a report with KBOO or reporting live from the scene made me feel like I was at least, I don't know if it's an entirely rational feeling, it made me feel like I was actually addressing it. And at least it took away that feeling of helplessness. And so
that's exactly what I mean. That you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now my chosen field of activity is working with bark, trying to preserve the forest in Mount Hood. And as an environmentalist who's aware of what the data is, I realize that nothing any of us is going to do is going to make a difference in the long run in terms of what happens to the climate. Fortunately, I'm an old person, and I don't have that much longer to go to do this, but that doesn't stop me from doing it. I do it because it's the right thing to do, and I don't know how long it is before the collapse is going to come, but I'll work every day until that happens.
Right on. Well, I appreciate you calling in. Go ahead.
I'm
going to conclude there.
Just trying to encourage people to realize that we do what we do not because we know what the outcome is going to be, not because we have any expectation, but because it's the right thing to do. And don't let despair keep you from work. You can experience despair, but once you go through it, you realize there's still so much to fight for, and the despair doesn't have to keep you paralyzed.
Right on. Thank you very much for that comment.
Okay.
Well, I called for comments on Facebook, and I did get one from Joe Clement, and he wrote, "Note for the show, look up Just Give Everyone Food Stamps on KBOO for a commentary and reading on just that proposition from yours truly and Matt Brunig. We need to reduce work, reduce and strategize our economic activity around human need. It is already possible certain sectors have to be developed, but much of our economy needs to go. A Green New Deal has to be about transforming the economy away from growth, wages, and sales. Giving food stamps to all gives people an economic support so they don't need to work as much." Thank you, Joe. And as long as I'm talking about that, would like to remind you that Monday mornings we have the Old Mole Variety Hour, and that is a very academic-heavy show, and that's a grand thing because these people truly understand Marxism and can apply hundreds of years of analysis to the situation that we are in now, and so it's quite a valuable thing, and I look forward to it myself. Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7, KBOO.FM, on Monday mornings, every Monday morning. So you are listening to KBOO Portland, KBOO.FM, and we brought up many topics here and have moved on to climate change, and have been talking about how climate change broke 120,000 records in the U.S., and I want to bring it home. Sometimes you notice subtle things that tell you that the climate has changed. The raindrop diameter size has increased in Portland. It's not just you. It's really true that the rain comes down harder because the raindrop diameter is measured by meteorologists and it has been increasing for more than a decade. So that rain comes down harder and you'll notice other things, like you will see a bird or an insect that you haven't seen before, and this is because these creatures are moving up from the southern reaches of the West Coast and from other parts of the United States where their climate is no longer supporting them, and so they are the ones that survive are spreading north, and so this will eventually include certain animals that are not seen. It is happening off the coast of Oregon where fish that normally are seen hundreds of miles south of here are starting to show up off the coast of Oregon and may eventually, ironically, revitalize some of the fishing industry, which will have to change to a different ecosystem as that changes. That's it's a little sad to contemplate, but it's, you know, this the sort of thing, I suppose it's irreversible, is actually happening right now. And so those who are able to deal with it are those who are able to look at it with clear eyes and say, okay, this is happening. This is actually happening now. And don't kid yourself that it's gradual or it's going to show up in 100 years. That ain't the case. Climate change is happening, and the disasters associated with it were happening right now, and so are, for that matter, the opportunities, if you want to look at it that way, and why not? Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Talked about how this economy is set up to keep you from getting ahead, basically. I almost don't like to use that phrase, getting ahead, because it sounds greedy. I'm talking about, when I say getting ahead in this context, I'm really referring to the fact that this economy is set up to keep you from being viable, from being stable, from having a good and happy life in which you don't have to spend the majority of your time working or fretting about not having enough work or not having enough cash. That is something that, for a certain part of the population, you know, and why beat around the bush, for whites, was possible from the late 40s through the mid 70s. It was possible to get ahead, to build up wealth, and that sort of thing still has an effect. People were able to provide educations for the kids, and there are the stability of our technology and the strength of our infrastructure now, today, and right days from 2020. Still draws some strength from that period of a better distribution of wealth, even if it was just for a section of the population. How much better it would be if we could distribute, if we could redistribute the trillions of dollars that have been unjustly sucked up into a tiny fraction of the economy. If we could seize and redistribute the illegally abducted trillions that go into offshore banks in Aruba and other banks in the Lesser Antilles, just to keep them away from the U.S. Tax dollar. I think that not only should they be taxed, they should be taken entirely, because they were criminally snatched away from the society generally. There is so much money, and we could all be so much wealthier, and we could at least have a society in which we are able to anticipate that we and our children and our friends and the society generally are able to continue in a stable way. And there also, I must insist, is plenty of money for a Green New Deal, and that's what I want to agitate for on this show. I thank you for your calls. Once again, coming up on KBOO at 10 o'clock, it's going to be Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, it's Book Wave, National Book Award winning novelist Ha Jin, going to discuss latest book, The Banished Immortal. At 11:30, you can hear Words and Pictures, where host S.W. Conser will speak to Raina Telgemeier, author and illustrator who has inspired many young readers with her graphic memoirs, Smile and Guts. KBOO is an independent, non-commercial community radio station powered by our volunteers and our members, and you've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland, news you're not supposed to know. And we go out to you via 90.7 FM on our great big red and white transmitter on the West Hills and other frequencies elsewhere here in Cascadia, and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.